Hello and welcome to Ag PhD Radio, broadcasting from the Morton Studio today. I'm Darren Hefty along with my brother Brian. We're going to be talking about spray additives, and man, there are a lot of different products out there. We'll try to simplify it a little bit for you on today's program. We'll also be taking your calls and questions throughout the show. You can always call us 844-44-AG-PHD, or you can email us radio@agphd.com if you've got a question. And of course, you can do both. And a lot of times, if you've got a complicated situation, you might send us an email with a soil test or a water test or a manure test or something like that, and then give us a phone call to chat about that just a little bit. You know, when it comes to these spray additives, there are so many different things right now and so many different categories that we look at. So we've got a few experts that we're going to have on the show as well today to talk about what's going on in their part of the world and some different considerations you might have. A lot of this comes down to which product you're mixing with, what are the weather conditions, and then what are the tank mixes? And it was so easy for a little while there when a lot of times we were just going out spraying Roundup back in the late 1990s and early 2000s. And then, of course, well, we had some issues with that. So we did learn from that. We knew that was not the best solution. But, man, it was pretty hard to not do that when it was so inexpensive to do. So I understand why a lot of guys got trapped into that.
What are you saying? What are you saying is the problem?
I said back when it was just Roundup, it was so simple. Oh, yeah, I'm spraying Roundup. Here's what I add to that. Now I'm mixing like three or four things together, and the additive choices get a little bit more complex.
Yeah, but even let's go back to the early Roundup days. We were told, hey, don't throw crop oil in, even if you're throwing a volunteer corn killer in. And that was bad advice because then the volunteer corn herbicide did not work as well. You needed crop oil even back then. So you can go even back to those days, and there was just misinformation out there. So that's the reason why we talk about this stuff. Now, you talk about simple. I have always tried to keep it to, hey, either I'm doing ammonium sulfate or in rare cases, I'll do liquid 28%, but either way, I'm getting a nitrogen source. And the advantage to ammonium sulfate, obviously, is I'm sequestering hard water ions, too. But then the other side is I'm either using crop oil or I'm using non-ionic surfactant. And then, I mean, you can throw methylated seed oil in there, too. So we've got a couple of oils, you got surfactant if you don't want as much burn. So I've tried to keep it as simple as possible just with that. But the big thing I look at now is dicamba and then 2,4-D. And you can't just use any adjuvant you want. It has to be on the approved list. And then you have to have something that's going to reduce drift, one of these drift reduction agents. And yeah, it has gotten a lot more complicated. So it's much easier. And if you're listening today, if you've got specific mixes or specific products that you have questions about, ask your agronomist. And you can certainly ask us as well.
All right, I've got a number of specific questions that have come in, Brian. Let's dive into the Ag PhD mailbag. We'll tackle a few of these.
It's the mailbag!
All right, speaking about herbicides, Jeff says, do you feel that tillage or planting disturbs the soil too much and breaks the herbicide barrier?
Well, planting, no, I'm not too worried about that, unless you had row cleaners set way down to move lots of dirt. Then it's possible. Otherwise, I would say that as far as the tillage goes, you just have to stay shallow. So what we've always said is two things. Number one, you got to drive super fast. And number two, so like 7 or 8 miles an hour. And number two, you got to run something that's not a disc. Use a field cultivator, for example. Oh, and then I'll throw one other kicker in. If you want to run the whole machine higher, which is great, then just put extensions on the shanks or sweeps that are going to run behind your tires. That way you can cover the tracks, because that's the reason why a lot of guys say, oh, I got to run deeper because I got to cover the tracks. No, you don't. Just put extensions on, run those shanks or sweeps a little bit deeper, and then you don't have any worry. The rest of the machine can run pretty shallow. I actually prefer herbicides lightly incorporated because now I've got the herbicides in the right place and it takes less moisture. So we find that it works better in dry conditions when you have lightly tilled in the herbicide.
All right. Thanks for the question. Had this one come in from Dave in South Dakota. Dave was wondering if putting 3 gallons of 32% liquid nitrogen with 3 gallons of water in furrow would be safe to corn seed, or would it be too salty? He was wondering if that nitrogen in furrow or by the seed would be more important than phosphorus would be early on. That's why he was considering it.
Okay, so first of all, in a lot of the phosphorus products, I think about 918-9. 6246, AgriLiquids Pro Germinator. Almost everybody has a little bit of nitrogen in there. So we're not saying you can't have any nitrogen in furrow, but the amount of salt you have in total, that's the real key. So 3 gallons of liquid 28% in furrow, I just think that's a little too much. Now, as I say that, if you have lots of rainfall and heavy soil, it'll probably work fine. But the problem is, the 1 year it doesn't work fine, then you're going to lose a bunch of yield, and we don't want that to happen to you. So I would not put 3 gallons of liquid 28% or 32% in the furrow. If you want to do some liquid nitrogen, I would do it 2x2. We've had pretty good luck running 5, 10, maybe even higher gallonage, but 5 or 10 gallons I'd be perfectly comfortable with in a 2x2 kind of situation in most cases.
All right. Thanks.
One other thing. Sorry, I forgot to address the, is nitrogen more important or is phosphorus more important early? The phosphorus is more important early because a lot of phosphorus in the soil isn't available at cold temps. Nitrogen is available at colder temps. So that's the reason why everybody pushes you toward the phosphorus in the furrow rather than the nitrogen in the furrow, in addition to that whole salt thing.
Hey, thanks for the question, Dave. Yeah, it's always good to talk to other folks if you're thinking about making a big change, especially if you're going to use a risky product. We'd always recommend talking about it first, see if anybody else has tried that or why you may or may not consider it, and then just look at what could potentially go wrong. And oftentimes you just want to try something on a very small scale first, just in case. We'll get back to more of your questions and our discussion on spray additives after this.
Farming comes with trade-offs. An extra pass means dinner in the cab. An early morning becomes a late night. Unnecessary restrictions turn into headaches. But when you make Enlist herbicides the foundation of your herbicide program, the trade-offs will be in your favor. Effective weed control that's ready to work when you are. Flexible tank mix options and neighbor-friendly applications. All without the need to jump through hoops. See what you'll gain with America's most trusted herbicide system protecting your Enlist E3 soybean fields at Enlist.com.
During the Go Green Save Green event at C&B, you'll save plenty on John Deere riding lawn equipment. Save on select S and X Series lawn tractors, plus Z-Track Zero Turns. Visit C&B at DeereEquipment.com.
From machine storage buildings and farm shops to dependable buildings to house your livestock, regardless of building size or use, Morton has a building for every budget. To learn how we can help you expand your farm operation, visit MortonBuildings.com.
On your farm, you spend thousands on fertilizer every season. But how do you know if any nutrient you apply is paying for itself? Build a fertility plan like never before with Verify. With Verify's soil point to yield analysis, you can automatically see the connection between your soil test and yield data to see which fertilizer dollars will make you money and which won't. Go to verify.com to get started today. That's VRAFY.com.
Maverick Corn Herbicide from Valent USA has proven to be a key part of growers' success in fighting problematic weeds. But don't take it from us. Take it from agronomy manager Nate Honeck.
We've seen tremendous weed control that was sprayed in dry, hot conditions with very little rain within 2 weeks after application. Very easy application. Definitely tank mix well with the various products we used.
Visit Valent.com/Maverick to learn more about Maverick Corn Herbicide. Always read and follow label instructions.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ag PhD Radio, broadcasting from the Morton studio today. And you know what? A lot of folks are saying, well, it's just about planting season here. Well, I would say it this way. It is for sure spray season. It's time to get rolling on getting especially pre-herbicides out there. For some, it's burn down time. further south. It's already in crop spraying, so a lot of spraying happening right now. So we're talking about spray additives because there's certainly a lot of choices and different categories to take a look at. If you've got questions about any of these for your farm, you can always give us a call, 844-44-AG-PHD, or send us an email, radio@agphd.com. All right, got Greg Kruger on right now with Rosens to talk about this. Greg, how you doing?
Good. It's good to hear you again.
You bet. You bet. All right. Well, there's certainly a lot of spray additives. I know this is something that you spend a lot of time educating others about and looking at some of the choices and finding the premium products too. And that alone is just a challenge, finding which is the better product to use because there's a lot of different ones out there that all look like they're about the same.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. I think when I was at the university and we were doing all the testing for the dicamba products and the Enlist products, I'm sure that we went through tens of thousands of different spray additives, nutritionals, biologicals, biostimulants that could be added to that tank. So it's a confusing little world out there.
Brian tries to keep things really simple, and I like this approach of, all right, a lot of times we need a nitrogen source, and it's often ammonium sulfate or a liquid 28% type product. There are some other ammonium sulfate replacement products. What's the big differences in that category?
Yeah, so when we start thinking about water conditioning, there's really nothing better than AMS to bind up hard water, but there are other products out there that we can use to condition that water, whether it be pH or things like that. So as I start to think about it, I like AMS. When we start thinking about things like Liberty and they're asking for lots of AMS, there's a reason why that AMS is doing is going to do a good job of tying up the calcium, magnesium, things like that in the water. But as we start thinking of beyond that, there are other things we can do to drop the pH to get more activity out of the chemistries we're using or things like that.
You know, the other thing too, Greg, is drift. And there are certainly some different types of drift control products. I remember back when I was a kid and my dad first started putting a little bit of drift retardant in the spray. And man, it made those droplets big and it messed up our spray pattern. And Dad's like, wow, we're going to have to start with maybe 1/10 of the rate that they recommend just to make sure that we don't mess our spray pattern up. But now there's some really good products out there that do a nice job and don't create a lot of issues.
Yeah, the spray drift world is fantastic to from a scientist standpoint, right? There's so much we can do to modify that droplet and the way it performs. And as I think about drift control additives, there's really two things I can do to reduce drift from a chemistry standpoint. One is to make more uniform droplets, and by doing that, I get rid of the small droplets on that left tail of the distribution curve. The other thing I can do is shift that curve or make all the droplets that I'm producing larger. And there's pros and cons to both. When I make the large droplets or make all the droplets larger, like you were talking about, I can go too far and I can lose my coverage. But it also does give us a lot more opportunity to get rid of those driftable fines as we look at those products. So there's a few different categories of drift reduction technologies out there. And each one's going to behave a little bit different in terms of whether it's narrowing that distribution curve or shifting it.
Yeah, there are a lot of things to look at there. And also, Greg, one challenge has been just the different nozzles that we're using and specifically around dicamba and all the additives there. What are some lessons you've learned over the last few years with that?
Yeah, the dicamba one's interesting, right? We've done a really good job of showing that we can manage drift. And we can push that a long ways, but we've also, I think, done a good job of showing that we can make droplets too large for a lot of our applications. So as we think about that dicamba application, Extendamax or Ingenia, we've really got to a point where we're requiring these ultra-coarse spray droplets. And if we don't have the volume, we don't have the right surfactants in there to get that droplet to spread when it reaches the leaf surface, we're really not getting very good coverage. And when that happens, we will see a reduction in control. And maybe the most dangerous thing we see is that guys are using these nozzles that produce these ultra coarse droplets, using these drift reduction technologies that are required for dicamba, and carrying that into all their other applications. And some of our products like Liberty that require coverage are getting left behind and really not getting the most out of those applications.
Yeah, no doubt about it. There, each product needs something just a little bit different. That's why there's specific instructions for each one of them out there. We're talking with Greg Kruger here, who's done a lot of work on the additives over the years and works with Rosens now. Greg, thank you so much. We really appreciate having you on, and I'm sure this won't be the last time as we're just getting started with spray season here in the north.
Looking forward to it. Wish everybody a successful spray season.
You bet. Thanks, Greg. Got Jason Bond with us right now with Mississippi State. Jason, how are you today?
I'm doing well.
Oh, so glad he could join us. Hey, we're talking about spray additives here, and just one thing to start off, and we can certainly talk about different weed control options and so forth, but we hear a lot of discussion about methylated seed oil versus crop oils versus non-ionic surfactant, and then, of course, there's all kinds of variants from those categories. How do farmers sort through that? And then the specific question that we got is, ask Jason, should I have some of each of those on hand just in case I change up what my tank mix combination is?
Wow, that's a, that's a maybe a loaded question, definitely a deep question. There's probably, you can probably make a case for having some of each on hand. I believe that, you know, the NIS and the crop oil are two traditional, you know, longstanding surfactants that we use. They're maybe not as interchangeable as, say, a crop oil and MSO within the products that we use. So we use a fair amount of MSO with our rice herbicides, and that's kind of become a thing over the past decade or so. And seems to have helped the performance of some of those too. And then the MSO has become popular just for either real or perceived added punch, so to speak. You know, maybe you get a little bit better control. I think the big thing with it from a practical standpoint, from a science standpoint, is if there is going to be a situation where the surfactant may be the cause for some poor control, the MSO may be a little bit more consistent, and you would see that inconsistency a little less often than you would with a crop oil. And I hope I explained that correctly.
Well, we end up with so many different conditions. I know we ended up with a very, very low humidity the last couple of years as we went through drought. And then you get the opposite end of things, too, where it's really hot and really humid. And the plants just respond a lot differently to that. And, of course, weeds are out there in the same environment that our crop is. So we're trying to deal with them however we can. You know, when you look at these additives that we're using, Jason, just in about 1 minute here, what do you have for farmers that you think, hey, here's something, if you knew this, you'd have better performance this year?
Related to additives.
Is it just follow the label, or is there something else that's kind of common sense that you'd say, man, if you just knew these rule of thumbs, you'd be in good shape?
Yeah, I think, too, you follow the label. Because I don't think on our latitude, in our humidity during the average spray season, we can get into low humidity situations like what you described as well. But as a rule, it's usually going to be better humidity. So I think using the appropriate concentration of those products would be the best thing to do.
Yeah, it is interesting as you move around the country a little bit. There are some different challenges that come to this. I think that is the best advice, is just follow the label. They've done the testing on these things and worked with a lot of the universities to back that up. I'm talking with Jason Bond here with Mississippi State. Jason, thank you so much. Really appreciate having you on, and have a great season. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
My mom's got a new Case IH tractor, and it can do it all.
Bale hay all day.
See in the dark with its powerful LED lights.
Hook up all the implements.
Shift like a race car.
Steer with ease.
And it can also cool my juice box.
Yeah,
Her Case IH tractor can do everything she needs it to.
Looking for a tractor that can do it all? Check out caseih.com.
The hard-working, independent spirit of rural America can often be isolating. It's not often discussed, but mental health issues are real. Now's the time to lead by example, talk openly, and show that a strong mind is just as important as a strong body. FMC is proud to be working toward ending the misconceptions around mental health through awareness, guidance, and action. Together, we can uproot the stigma.
Warning, high yields incoming. Upgrading your planter with Germinator closing wheels can increase your corn yields by 13 bushels in no-till and 7 bushels in conventional. Are your bins ready? Call Farm Shop MFG at 712-520-6051.
Get more durability for less downtime with Soil Warrior Strip Tillage from Environmental Tillage Systems. Improve fertilizer efficiency and reduce passes and fuel usage. Now that's ROI. Learn more about ETS at soilwarrior.com.
Every season, you're collecting yield data on virtually every acre of your farm. But what good is your data if you never use it? Put it to work with Verify. Verify takes yield data directly from your combine and instantly generates variable rate fertility maps based on crop removal, ensuring your crops get what they need, right where they need it, no matter what equipment you run. Go to verify.com to find an expert to help you get started. That's VRAFY.com.
It's smart to make the right agronomic choices, and it's even smarter to get rewarded for them. With the Bayer Plus Rewards program, you earn cash back on seed, herbicides, and other eligible products. And it keeps getting smarter, because now you can earn an additional 10% bonus when you send your redemption check to your retailer. To learn more, contact your retailer today. Protect your yields and get the most from your land with Bayer Plus Rewards. Visit mybayerplus.com and see program terms and conditions for full details.
Maverick Corn Herbicide from Valent USA has proven to be a key part of growers' success in fighting problematic weeds. But don't take it from us. Take it from farmer Rob Schaefer.
Residuals have become a big part of our chemical programs with trying to battle water hemp, and also mare's tail is our big one. It's done a real good job of controlling those. You don't have to, you know, put a bunch of gallons in your sprayer, cover a lot of acres that way.
Visit Valent.com/Maverick to learn more about Maverick Corn Herbicide. Always read and follow label instructions.
You're listening to Ag PhD Radio, broadcasting from the Morton studio today and talking about spray additives. It's not going to be long. You'll be out in the sprayer. Maybe you're out there today. You're probably thinking about this. Oh, wow, I want to make sure whatever I'm spraying is going to work. And oftentimes there's a number of different additives you may need to put in there according to the label. We just had Jason Bond on from Mississippi State. His piece of advice, follow the label. If they want something a little different in there to make it work better, go with that. More times than not, that is the best choice. And of course, you do have to follow the label as you're using these products. I've got Jim Reese on right now with Precision Labs to talk a little more about this. How you doing, Jim?
I'm great. How you guys doing today?
We're doing well. We're doing well. Just entering spray season here on our farm. So, of course, spray additives are top of mind. But one challenge that we've had the last few years, Jim, has been low humidity. Do you have any tips for us if we have to spray, but our humidity levels are really low? What can we do to make those products more effective?
Probably a couple different things, right? So low humidity, probably have a little bit thicker leaf cuticles, right? So you're going to need a little bit longer dwell time and maybe some more power in penetrating that cuticle. I really like high surfactant oils in this situation. High surfactant MSOs are really a great fit here. And I would suggest, too, using deposition aids, help make sure that spray droplet survives the flight from the nozzle tip down to the target surface and then has time to be absorbed.
You know, the other thing that we've run into, Jim, is we've got a lot of weed resistance issues, and there are quite a few products that are good on this weed but not good on that. So we end up with lots of tank mixes, and early season you end up with a lot of different fertilizer combinations going in with some of these pre's. Talk to us about compatibility, tank clean out. What about compatibility agents? What do we need to know here?
Well, always, you know, always mix in the right sequence, right? So first of all, I'd say compatibility agents always go in first, right? It's so much easier to prevent a problem than trying to fix a problem, because over half of them are not fixable. Once you make cottage cheese, you're kind of stuck with cottage cheese. So if you're using a compatibility agent up front, probably the first or second thing you put in the tank is the best way to manage that. And then I'd say the other hint, because we do see so many guys adding wanting to spray in UAN, for example, not a huge issue, but make sure you're using a compatibility agent. If you're trying to add ATS to it, ammonium thiosulfate, make sure that goes in very last. Even if it's a significant part of your carrier, you know, maybe 5, maybe even 10 gallons per acre, make sure you add it last. And then you, that with a compatibility agent, you can probably get about anything to work.
You know, as we're spraying, there's a lot of different technologies out there and a lot of different products, and it does get a little bit confusing. How do you suggest farmers sort through all the different additives that are out there? I mean, even Precision Labs, I look at how many different products that you work with and all the different segments, from golf courses to residential use to big crop acres like corn and soybeans. I mean, you get to work with all of that. How do you keep it simple for farmers to make those choices?
Well, I think, you know, Gak, you make a great point, Darren. There's been estimates of over 2,500 different adjuvants just in the U.S. market, right? So how do you narrow it down? I think a good first step is looking at Dr. Young's adjuvant compendium at Purdue. Next step would be just choosing CPDA-certified adjuvants. So that's a really good indication that what you're getting is what is really on the label, right? And it's not just some snake oil stuff that who knows who made it or if the claims are even valid. But just going back into the point of Dr. Bond, right, and look at the label. What does it require? And you can really narrow it down to, you know, surfactants, a good high surfactant oil, HSMSO, MSOs, or HSOCs. It can be. It doesn't have to be super complicated. And then, of course, if you're trying to control off-target movement, make sure you've got a drift reduction agent in there as well.
One of the questions that we've got in, Jim, is just about around combo products that have a surfactant, a drift control agent, and often one other thing in there. What do you think about the combo products? Are they getting a bigger market share each year just with all the tank mixes guys are doing?
Yeah, I think they have for years, right? I think the desire to be for convenience, right, and have as much functionality wedged into one container as possible. But I think that's also the real watch out, in that I see products out there that claim to be a surfactant, a penetrant, an oil, a water conditioner, a deposition aid, a drift retardant, a spreader, a sticker, and then they're doing it all with, you know, 20% active ingredient, 80% inerts, and a ultra-low use rate, right? So I'd really caution people to start to think about what the label's telling you. Does it really make sense you can put all that technology at a functional level into a formulation at ultra-low use rates? You might want to be careful as you start looking at premixes that claim too much functionality.
Yeah, there's always a lot of big claims on some of these products that want to advertise to every market fit. There's no doubt about that. Because look at what we're doing as farmers. We're farming, in many cases, more acres, and even custom application rigs are being asked to cover more acres. It's amazing, the folks that do that job, how many fields they have to try to get to in the weather windows that are the best for spraying. They often end up with the same challenges that farmers end up: running too fast. What are some of the risks, Jim, of running too fast, maybe not using enough water, or obviously not covering every single acre at the ideal time? It's putting a lot of pressure on these things to work.
You know, it really is, Darren. Running too fast is one of the beginning recipes of just poor coverage, right? I never thought it'd be a dot counter, you know, a droplet counter. Always like to talk about droplet size and its ability to move off target or stay on target. But, you know, just the sheer number of droplets that we make a big difference on coverage, right? And just killing small, really ultra-small weeds when we should be trying to kill them. So I think, you know, slowing down, using more water. If you looked at some of the work that Dr. Brian Young has done over at Purdue, there's some really compelling evidence to slow down and spray a little higher water volumes, and you can really improve or make a huge difference in performance of your pesticide applications.
Now, when we're heading through the fields, what would you like? And this probably varies by product, but do you want to keep those droplets together longer? Do you want them to just soak into the leaf as fast as possible? What should we really be looking for as we're making applications this season?
It probably really depends on the chemistry you're spraying, but for the most part, I want to make sure my droplets survive the flight, right? So I don't want to make droplets that are so small that they evaporate in flight, or they barely make it to the target and then they evaporate like that and they're gone, right? Then there's no dwell time. So I want to make sure I'm making probably, and for the most part, coarse to extra coarse droplets that I know it can hit the target. They'll survive the flight. They're going to have adequate dwell time on the leaf surface. And then, you know, if they're using an oil-soluble pesticide, you know, I want to make sure I've got an oil-based adjuvant in there, or I'm using water-soluble, probably just a good non-extrapactant. Or anymore, with all the tank mixing that you mentioned earlier, that's another great place for high surfactant oils that cover both sides of the tank mix spectrum, from oil-loving to water-loving.
Yeah, we're seeing a lot more demand on the market for those types of products, no doubt about that. We're talking with Jim Reese here with Precision Labs, industry leader in spray additives. Jim, thank you so much. We really appreciate having you on, and good luck this spring.
Hey, you too. Have a safe spring.
You bet. Yeah, there's going to be a lot of hours in the sprayer this year, I'm sure, when it comes to controlling bugs and weeds and diseases and mites and all the things that can impact a field. A lot of non-farmers send in questions throughout the season. Man, what are you doing out there so many times? Believe me, we're not trying to be in the sprayer any more than we have to, but we do want to salvage our crop out there. So we're talking about how to make each of those passes as valuable as possible by having the right spray additives in there. Again, I go back to consult your labels on each product, and then where there are some differences, if you're combining two products together and one wants a surfactant and the other wants an oil, talk to your agronomist about, hey, what are you seeing on these combos and which way should I go on the additives to make sure I get the best performance and the best crop safety too. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
If you look close enough, you can see the hidden potential within your fields. That's why an AgroLiquid nutrition plan starts with the crop and identifies the precise combination of primary nutrients while focusing on the support of secondary and micronutrients. So every nutrient is working in harmony for your crop to reach its full potential, maximizing growth while offering lower use rates. Apply less, expect more? Precisely. Find an AgroLiquid dealer at agroliquid.com.
Nothing but net. Win your soybean season with the fast knockdown and lasting broad-spectrum control of Elevest Insect Control from FMC. Take on armyworms, stink bugs, soybean loopers, and more with the maximized ratio of premier active ingredients for better overall control of more than 40 labeled pests. Visit your FMC retailer or elevest.ag.fmc.com to up your game this season. Always read and follow all label directions.
Weeds rob you of yield potential, so rob them of the chance to grow with powerful corn herbicide solutions from Corteva Agriscience. Weeds won't know what hit them, but you will, because you can count on proven top herbicides like Resicor or Sure Start 2 or the new game-changing herbicide Cairo to effectively control weeds. That way, you spend less time worrying about unwanted yield-robbing weeds and have more time to power on with your day. Learn more at poweroverweeds.com.
Your farm's greatest challenge is making sure your crop has enough fertility to reach its yield goals. But how do you know if you're applying too much of any one nutrient? Fine-tune your fertility plan with Verify. Your combine collects hundreds of yield data points per acre. Verify takes that data and instantly generates variable rate fertility maps based on crop removal, so you can be confident you're not over-applying. Get started today at verify.com. That's V-R-A-F-Y.com.
Are you being offered a complete seed treatment package? If your seed treatment doesn't help against soybean diseases like white mold, sudden death syndrome, and Rhizoctonia, then it's not complete. Heads Up Seed Treatment offers protection against all of these diseases through its unique mode of action, systemic acquired resistance. Don't get caught off guard in 2024. Get the best defense against the unpredictability of each season by completing your seed treatment package with Heads Up. Visit headsupst.com to learn more.
Morton Buildings has served the American farmer for more than 120 years. From manufacturing our own building components to constructing your building, Morton takes pride in being the industry leader in post-frame construction by providing a quality building and exceptional customer service. A Morton is built to last for generations. To get started on your next project, please visit MortonBuildings.com.
Listening to Ag PhD Radio, broadcasting from the Morton studio today, talking spray additives and taking your questions, 844-44-AG-PHD. All right, Brad, let's dive back into the Ag PhD mailbag here. Get a couple of questions around potassium and magnesium. First of all, from Levi, what's a good ratio between potassium and magnesium?
Well, what we usually talk about with the magnesium to potassium ratio, it's roughly 1:1 to 2:1 in terms of parts per million. However, every lab is going to do things a little bit differently. So I would just say you got to kind of test things out yourself with whatever lab you're using. What I'm talking about is Midwest Labs, Malik 3, 1:1, 2:1, somewhere in that range. That's what we like to see, magnesium to potassium. The problem is if you get outside that range, for example, let's say you're 5:1 magnesium to potassium, you might say, oh, wow, that's a big difference. Oh, we see that all the time. And when that happens, then you're not going to get potassium into the plant like you think you should. When you run plant tissue analysis, you'll find that you'll be excessive on magnesium, or at least high, and you'll be really low or deficient on potassium just week after week after week. So we need to get that ratio right. However, what we usually talk about is base saturation. That way we're looking at 5 nutrients rather than just 2. But if you said, hey, all I want to do is look at 2 nutrients, okay, that's your magnesium to potassium ratio.
All right, another question along the same lines is, why are magnesium and potassium linked? Is it because they compete at exchange sites in the soil, or is it something different?
I'm not exactly sure what it is, but so let's put it this way. I don't really ultimately care about the science behind why it happens. What I care about is that it happens and when it happens. So in other words, if I've got high levels of magnesium in the soil in relation to potassium or vice versa, then we just get ourselves out of balance. And you can see that very plainly in terms of the plant tissue analysis when you run it. So, yeah, I don't know exactly why. I'm sure there's a scientist out there who can tell me, but that's, I guess, what I would say. I believe, yeah, it obviously somehow is competing, getting into the plant. I just don't know exactly the mechanism.
All right, thanks for the question. I got this one that came in from Zach about pasture and also spring wheat. He sent in a couple of soil tests. Zach is from Oregon, it looks like. He said, guys, I'm wondering what you think I should do to improve my soil. All my ground is irrigated, and you can see what my pasture ground looks like and also what my spring wheat ground looks like. Just looking for ideas here. So looking at tests, they're from a different lab here. I'm just kind of sorting through some of these numbers. Brian, what's jumping out to you on Zach's tests? I do like the idea that it's irrigated, too. That gives us some options here.
Sure, it does. But I guess I would just say we don't have all the information that I would like to see. I don't know what the cation exchange capacity numbers are. I don't see base saturation. So I would say this, when we're looking at, let's see, it looks like a bicarbonate P test. So that's most likely an Olson test, and it's pretty low. We're talking Wait a second. 20. Okay. Whenever I see numbers that are exactly the same on two different tests, I'm always questioning things, but no, the third one was different. So it's 24, 20, and 20. So those are pretty low. The potassium numbers, parts per million, 693, 791, 705. So without seeing base saturation and without knowing, let's see. Oh, yeah, and I don't know what our actual calcium parts per million is, what our magnesium parts per million. It's really hard. I just don't have all the information. But it appears to me that he needs phosphorus, doesn't need any potassium. I can't imagine potassium would be a problem.
Yeah, and the pH, one thing that's kind of interesting here, too, he's got a couple different samples out of the pasture. Down on the bottom ground, that pH is a full point higher than it is on the higher ground. And that's
well, there's free lime there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so definitely different soils. There's definitely some variability out there where you would handle those two areas of the pasture differently.
Well, yeah, but what are you going to do different?
Well, with the free lime, that does change things up. And like you say, I don't have
But there's literally nothing that you're going to do different. I don't know what you would do different because in both spots, he's got very high potassium. Phosphorus is low. Sure, the pH, it's 7.5 and it's 6.4, but that's not like it's that big a deal. Like I say, yeah, it's the free lime that's throwing that off. The problem is I don't know if he's going to be willing to invest in drain tile, which is that and sulfur are how you're going to fix that and flush that free lime out of there. Well, that's not cheap. That's not easy to do. But in terms of the overall fertility program, normally I'm not really going to change a whole lot in this particular case. So I don't know. There is total bases here. So it's not in the cation exchange capacity box, but there is total bases. And it just is way higher in that spot, obviously, because of the free lime. So there's not a hydrometer used to test cation exchange capacity or anything in this case. But what there is you can make calculations and you go, oh, okay, well, there's a bunch more calcium there. Yeah. But it's free lime. And what that basically means is there's so much calcium, it's not even all attaching to the soil. So that's where if you improve the drainage, it's going to flush out over time. Granted, it might be a long time, but then to Darren's point, the pH would start to neutralize. But other than that, I really don't know what you're going to do different. Tile and throw sulfur out there. But it's not like it's super cheap.
Nope, it's sure not. I had a question come in today. This one came in from Jacob, and he is in Minnesota. He said, hey, guys, I've followed your show for quite some time. I've got a complete soil test here. I put all the data into your fertilizer Excel sheet on your website, and it tells me I need 953 pounds per acre. Something didn't seem right about putting that much potassium out. It's 745 pounds of potash. Something didn't seem right about putting that out in the spring. I'm wondering if I should save that for the fall. This field that I'm talking about here has been corn. As long as I've owned it, it's going to be corn during this bill program. And tillage is a dual ripper currently. But once I get levels corrected, I want to go to strip till like the rest of my farm.
Okay, but here's the thing. You don't have to put that all on in one shot. What we're talking about is you are that far short from being in balance in your soil. So if you want to work on it over the next 3 years, that'd be just fine. We talked about the same type of question just yesterday, and I said, no, I'm probably not doing a build program in the spring. I might build a little bit, but I'm not going to go nuts in the spring. I would probably do it in the fall, but if you say, hey, I can't afford this in one shot anyway, so I don't want to do it this fall, okay, we'll work on it over the next 3 years. It's not that big a deal. I know it sounds like a lot of pounds, but you break that down over 3 years, and it's not that much. Yes, it's going to cost some money, but the big thing I always tell people is with phosphorus and potassium, I mean, unless you have a real light soil and lots of rain, but phosphorus and potassium, they aren't going anywhere. So you get them out there, you get things in balance, now your plants are going to do better, and the excess is going to stay there until your crop uses it in the future. But you've got to keep your potassium level high because I'm assuming your calcium and magnesium are high in your soil as well.
All right. Thanks for the question, Jacob. got this one in from PD, and he said, "Hey guys, I love your show. Love how you answer a lot of these questions in a similar way. I'm just curious, could you add a flow chart to display visually how you work through these soil tests? A flow chart could show some common or basic considerations that'd be helpful. I realize there's a lot of variance out there too." Thanks, Petey. We appreciate that. Yeah, it is tough. Every one of these fields is just a little different, and the cropping situation that comes with it and so forth makes that a little bit challenging to do.
Yeah, but I'll think about that before we do our soils clinic next winter, and maybe there's a little different way that we could describe stuff.
If you have a question for us, you can call us 844-44-AG-PHD or send us an email, radio@agphd.com. We'll be right back.
Get uniform control in your fields with trusted, hardworking Lucento fungicide. Control the toughest diseases with a dual mode of action fungicide that consistently outperforms the competition and field trials. Lucento fungicide from FMC works overtime for lasting control to help improve crop yields. Talk about getting the job done. Visit your FMC retailer or lucento.ag.fmc.com for hardworking control in your fields. Always read and follow all label directions.
Are you ready for better efficiency, more productivity, higher yields? Then you're ready for John Deere Precision Technology, which starts with three core pieces. First, a G5 display gives fast views of your work and a window to future technology. A Starfire receiver gives you sub-inch repeatable accuracy without an RTK base station. And a JD-Link modem gives you a live view of your entire operation. Get precise and talk with your John Deere dealer or visit johndeere.com/Facebook.
Here at Ag PhD, we're always looking for ways to support the next generation in the ag industry. That's why at our free Ag PhD Scouting and Scholarships event on Saturday, June 29th, we're giving away more than 100 college scholarships. Join us as we head into the field for hands-on sessions covering everything from how to pull soil and tissue samples, ways to improve crop health, the importance of microbiology in farming, and much more. Plus, in our comprehensive guide to crop scouting, we'll explore both above and below ground in a variety of crops as we diagnose problems with insects, weeds, diseases, and anything else we may find. As we're giving away tens of thousands of dollars in scholarships to eligible attendees, this day is geared more towards students and young farmers, but anyone with a desire to learn more about agronomy is more than welcome. So whether you're a college student or just want good agronomy information, this is one event you won't want to miss. Come to the Ag PhD Scouting and Scholarships Day, Saturday, June 29th on the Hefty Farm near Baltic, South Dakota. Learn more and register at agphd.com.
It's smart to make the right agronomic choices, and it's even smarter to get rewarded for them. With the Bayer Plus Rewards Program, you earn cash back on seed, herbicides, and other eligible products. And it keeps getting smarter, because now you can earn an additional 10% bonus when you send your redemption check to your retailer. To learn more, contact your retailer today. Protect your yields and get the most from your land with Bayer Plus Rewards. Visit mybayerplus.com and see program terms and conditions for full details.
Because the challenges you face are getting bigger every year, BASF is committed to helping with more than boots on the ground. We're committed to boots in the mud, boots on the steps of your truck, your tractor, your combine, the linoleum tiles of your coffee shop, the concrete of your co-op, the gravel in your shed. So we can listen, learn firsthand, help right now to ensure success. BASF, helping you do the biggest job on earth.
You're listening to Ag PhD Radio. Thanks for joining us today. We are right in the middle of the Ag PhD mailbag time, taking your calls and questions at 844-44-AG-PHD, or you can email us, radio@agphd.com, and that is exactly what Stan did. He's down in Alabama. He's got poultry litter access, and just kind of curious on the fertilizer program. He said, "I've been farming sandy creek bottom soils with cation exchange capacities 5 to 9, so lighter soil." He said, I've been using poultry litter, and I've included those samples and also my grid soil samples. I'm wondering, can I apply up to 10 tons per acre? I'm trying to build organic matter, and man, it's a lot cheaper than commercial fertilizer right now to use litter. My soil samples have extremely low or even zero salt indicated on the reports, and they did test for that. I'm just kind of curious what should be my limiting factors as I consider this poultry litter for my farm.
Okay, so when I take a look at his poultry litter, it says nitrogen, first year available, 20. And how many tons did you say he wanted to put on?
He would like to go as high as 10, but he said...
Okay, well, that's 200 pounds. And what did you say his CEC was?
5 to 9.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, and first, that's the question. Is first year availability, is that immediate availability, or is that going to come available at some point during the first year?
Well, the problem is they don't break it out. So most manure and compost samples I look at, they break it out and they say how much is organic and how much is ammonium. And if they do that, then I can tell you a lot better. So otherwise, I'm just guessing. Now, in total, there's 33 pounds per ton of nitrogen. First year available, 19.8. My assumption is there's probably at least 12 or 14 that's available today. So that becomes the problem. Yes, I get it, and I understand where you're going with this, that, hey, it's going to release slowly over time. Well, only a portion of it is going to release slowly over time. So that's one of the factors. Next factor I'm looking at is the phosphate is 76 pounds per ton. So if you're going to put 10 tons on, you've got 760 pounds of phosphate. That sounds like a lot to me. That'd be the equivalent of roughly, just ballpark, 1,500 pounds of MAP. I mean, that seems like an awful lot of stuff that we're going to put out in one shot.
That would raise your parts per million by 165 in one shot. Well, and there's some of that that's 30.
Well, keep in mind, this is phosphate,
30s.
But yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
So anyway, would I do that? No. I mean, that seems really high. So that's my concern.
Yeah, it's tricky. And then also the other side of that is this is a creek bottom soil. And man, if you have any kind of flooding and you've got phosphorus on the surface, that's not a good deal.
Yep. No, you're in bad shape. So I'm all for building phosphorus. Don't get me wrong. But there are levels out there already where there are 200, 250 pounds of phosphorus. So I'm not saying that's unbelievably high. These are Malic 3 tests. Okay, keep in mind that's not what's just what's available today. That's more like a P2 Bray test. And that's part pounds, not parts per million. So in those spots, that's where we say, hey, I really don't want to go nuts. Now, I see there are other areas where there are 8 pounds. So there, I'm going to put an awful lot more on.
You know, it's the samples, too, are a little different. And every lab is just a little bit different. So when you're looking through, this is a Malic 1 test.
Sorry, yeah.
This is Malic 1.
I said Malic 3. It's Malic 1.
And the other thing, when you look at the base saturation percentages, which it's potassium, magnesium, calcium, hydrogen, and sodium, they don't have a sodium reading. I'd be curious to see what that would be.
Sure.
And they haven't tested for sodium. And then the hydrogen percentage, even where a pH is 7, they've got a hydrogen at 24.7%. And that's just
so that's not right.
Yeah, that's just not going to be. You're not going to have a hydrogen percentage when you get to a 7 pH, which is neutral or above. So I don't know. There's some things there that I'm not excited about. To me, I'd like Malic 3 better than Malic 1. And I also, I also really would love to see them run a sodium number, especially in areas where litter is involved.
Yep, for sure.
All right. Well, thank you, Stan. We appreciate the question.
Hey, let me throw one other thing out. When we're talking light soil, like he's got, there's a lot of 10 CEC or less. A lot of times labs don't even run the sodium because they believe that it's going to end up leaching out. But sodium doesn't just leach out unless you've got sulfur or something else to make it a salt. So, yeah, I'm with you. I would absolutely like to see the sodium.
All right. I had this question come in from Bob about seed size. And he said, I'm curious, you guys have talked about soybean seed size. What about corn seed size? Does it matter? And do you want a bigger seed or a smaller seed to plant ideally?
Go ahead, Darren. You can talk about seed size a
well,
little bit.
Here's the
Darren
thing.
Darren does a lot of work with the seed breeders and seed labs
and we do look at a lot of tests, both warm germination tests, cold germination tests, and so forth. And we do see some slight differences based on seed size, but it's not that much. It's a percent or two different. Honestly, ideally, I'd love to have the seed from the middle of the ear. I'd love to have a larger flat, and I'd love to have a medium round, something like that. But when you get the smallest rounds, that's where the last couple of years with drought conditions, we've seen more issues with lower germination, lower quality, because that's the kernel that's going to get aborted first if that corn plant suffers. And then the same thing, depending on how wet or dry it is and how rough the handling is at harvest in the seed corn fields, those large rounds at the very bottom of the ear can suffer more damage too. But if it makes it through that whole process, generally it isn't a huge difference in terms of germination. Then I just think about, okay, well, how much moisture does it take for a great big seed to start that process? If I'm in a very dry area, maybe I say, maybe if I have a choice, I'd go with a little bit smaller seed than bigger. And if you're in an area where you've got unlimited water and you say, well, I might want a bigger seed, I really don't think it makes much difference. Personally, I look at what the variety is and what the germination scores are and go from there. And I don't really care if it's big or small, as long as it meets those qualifications. Any other preference you have, Brian? And it plants well. That's going to be the big thing too.
Right. Yeah, I agree with you on the seed size. Now let's flip this around and let's talk about just anyone raising any grain that there is. If you can get bigger seed, even slightly bigger seed, you now have more bushels to sell. You have more weight there. So we talk all the time about trying to build seed size as much as we can. That would be having great levels on all fertility things like phosphorus and potassium that we talk about all the time. But I mean, beyond that, you just want to keep that plant as stress-free as possible. So in theory, would it be likely that if I had just slightly bigger seed size, could I maybe have a little bit more vigor there? It's possible, but we don't always know because every variety is a little bit different. Some varieties, the seeds are just smaller, period. So, I mean, if you say, oh, I've got this seed, and then you have another variety that has normally bigger seeds, well, that doesn't necessarily mean the one variety is good and the other variety is bad.
Okay, thanks for the question. Had this one come in from Ryan, and he said, I'm in southern Minnesota. I have an apple and plum orchard that I recently started, but I'm having trouble with insect damage to my apples. Last year, I lost about 80% of my crop. Oh, man, that's tough. That's tough. Sorry to hear that, Ryan. He said, I was wondering what you guys might spray or if you have any recommendations on what I could apply and when to apply it. I'll be using a backpack sprayer or a three-point sprayer with a wand. I'm guessing these trees are fairly small yet. I know there's some really good guides out there, Ryan. We're not the fruit tree guys, although a lot of those active ingredients we get to use in row crops and other uses. But Purdue has a really nice fruit tree spray guide with timings and lots of different products, and it's free. It's a free download. So check that out. Look up Purdue's fruit tree spray guide. And then also Washington State University's got a lot of guides. I imagine that Washington would have information on apples and apple production. But I would check those two sites out first and start there and then take a look at what's available in your area and which particular problems you've got, what particular insect it is as well. That'll get you down the right path. Good luck this season. Hopefully it goes much, much better than it did last year. Thanks for listening to today's program. We enjoyed talking about spray additives. If you have specific questions on specific tank mixes, you can send them to us, radio@agphd.com. Thanks for listening. Be sure to join us again each weekday for more Ag PhD Radio.